Thank you, Robin. So yesterday, a number of us were over on the Windward side, and we were guests, along with many others, at Kauai Nui, as we were celebrating World Wetlands Day. Much mahalo to Chuck and the support that Clara gives to Chuck as he runs around and creates all these amazing things happening. And yesterday at Kauai Nui, there was this opportunity to celebrate that amazing space that is being recreated there on the Windward side. And I was privileged to be part of a panel that was looking at the impacts of climate change on Kauai Nui, on Oahu, on our nation, on our world. And there were a whole bunch of folks that knew a whole lot more than I, and I was just happy to be there next to a part of them. But what was really interesting was that some of it was framed, our panel was framed by the person who was facilitating an interpretation of a chant that was written about Kauai Nui when it had gone from being this magnificent fish pond to beginning to fall apart. And in the chant that was written in the 19th century, it talks about how Wahine, this demigoddess who lived there, was sort of the caretaker of Kauai Nui, caretaker really of Ko'olaupoko, all that association of Ahupua'a there on the Windward side. And how Wahine had always guaranteed that there would be beauty and there would be abundance in this land as long as the people lived lives that were pono, that lived lives that were balanced, that lived lives that were connected, in which they cared for one another and they cared for the land. But when the people stopped doing that, sometime in the middle of the 19th century, when things began to fall apart, and there are lots of historical reasons for that, Hauwahine is said to have departed and said would not return again until people lived pono lives again in that region. And so gathered there with Chuck and so many others, scientific clubs and clubs that are there gathered around Ulupo Heiau and all those, you are gathered with folks that are in fact working hard to heal that historical disconnect that has happened over time on the Windward side and in so many other places between ourselves as human beings and the land that God has called us to be partners of, to be part of the creation of. And it is a story of disconnect and dysfunction that so many are working to try and turn around. Now, the story that Robin just read for us from another time, in another setting, in another place, is also a story that at its root is a story about disconnect and dysfunction and the need to rebuild those connections. The story of Joseph actually takes up more chapters in the book of Genesis than any other story. More stories than Noah, more stories than Adam and Eve, more than Abraham. It takes up the biggest chunk of chapters in the book of Genesis. And it begins, as you all may know, with a family that is utterly dysfunctional. Joseph is one of 13 children, 12 boys, one woman. Story of Dinah, we will have to save for another day, of Dinah. We will save for another day, but there are these 12 boys that the story begins to function around. They are all the sons of Jacob, who is the son of Isaac, who is the son of Abraham. Abraham is the one that God had spoken to and said, I will lead you to this promised land, and I will make a covenant with you and all of your people. And so then the generations begin to amass after Abraham. And here is Jacob doing his part with 12 boys. Since it was a nicely patriarchal world, that's all we really were going to care about. Those 12 boys would become the 12 tribes of Israel that would carry on for the next 100 years, millennium, and so. But it was a family that was fractured from the very beginning. Jacob had 4 different women as mothers of his 13 children. 2 of the women were handmaids, slaves. And they each bore Jacob 2 children. And because of their status, they actually had no status. And their story, we hear nothing more about. Most of his children were born to the older sister of 2 sisters, Rachel and Leah. Leah being the older one. Rachel is who he really wanted to be married to, but somehow he got tricked right in the time of getting married and ended up instead being married to Leah, had a whole bunch of kids, and finally he finds himself married once again, or finds himself with Rachel, and Rachel finally begins to give him the children that he has always wanted. So he's had like 11 already, and none of them quite meet the match. But finally along comes Joseph, the long-awaited friend. One, the promised son, the man that he wants so badly in his life. And then there's another that follows after, but really, who cares about him? It's Joseph that we really care about. And so Joseph comes along, and Joseph knows that he's the favorite. Knows it absolutely. Knows it to the point of utter arrogance. Arrogance to the point that his brothers cannot stand him. Now, I know none of us have had siblings that we can't stand. I know none of us have had siblings that we knew were the favorite in the family or anything else. So perhaps this is the only family this has ever happened to. But in this family, it wasn't working well. It was so utterly dysfunctional that the brothers came up with a scheme that I would not recommend if you happen to have a family in which the siblings don't really get along that well. Because the scheme was, we're going to take Joseph out and we are going to basically fake his death, tell Dad that he is dead so Dad will quit pining over Joseph, and then we are going to sell him, we're going to throw him into a hole, we're going to sell him into slavery, and we will be done with him for good, which is exactly what they do. And then he gets sold into slavery. And then Joseph gets sold again. And eventually, unbeknownst to the brothers, Joseph ends up now a slave in Egypt. They think they're done with him, gone with him, nothing to worry about. Instead, he's a slave in Egypt. And inextricably, through a series of events that happen over the next couple of decades, Joseph goes from being a slave to being the number two person in power in all of Egypt, which was pretty much the biggest deal in the world at that time. And as the number two person, he's basically in charge of the whole economy. And because he has this ability to dream dreams and have visions and see the world and see the future that's going to happen, Joseph realizes that we're about to have abundance here in Egypt. And because we're going to have abundance here in Egypt, we're also going to have abundance in all the lands that surround us, including Canaan, where his family is from. And we're going to have 7 years of abundance. But Joseph also understands not only are we going to have 7 years of abundance, but we're going to have 7 years after that of famine and drought. Now, Egypt is a wealthy country. Joseph is a wise man. He says, we're going to prepare for that famine and drought. And so during the time of abundance, we are going to take food and we are going to store it so that when there is famine and drought, we have food that we can take from. And in fact, we will store enough that even our neighbors will be able to have food. Now, if you are Jacob and his family, Joseph's brothers, and you're in Canaan, and you're shepherds, and you're nomads, abundance is lovely. During abundance, you get to feast. But famine and drought, you're nomads. You don't have a place to go store your food. You're in big trouble. And so this is the reality that happens about 3,500 years ago. Famine and drought comes to this region. Egypt is doing okay. They've stored up their food. But there, their neighbors in Canaan are struggling. And they make a decision to leave their home to go and find food. And when you think about it, in 3,500 years, things haven't changed all that much. People don't typically leave their home because, oh, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't like it anymore. It's because where I am is no longer able to meet my needs. And so today we have folks that are having to abandon their homes because of being in war-torn regions. In Syria, over 5 million refugees, over 5 million people have had to leave Syria as a result of that war. We have people that are having to leave because of the because of the violence within their own country. This caravan that we heard so much of, folks coming up through Central America, many of the folks in that caravan were folks that were leaving because of the violence that came from the drug lords that controlled their communities, or the dictators, the atrocious rulers that were leading their nations, rulers in many ways we up north had made sure were in place because they would have policies that would favor us. And so, just as it was 3,500 years ago, there are those that leave their places because, not because they want to leave, but because where they are can no longer provide. There was drought and famine. Throughout Central America right now, there is climate change-induced drought and famine, and the great agricultural regions that stretch through Central America are drying up, and there is not enough food, and so people are going to where they see there has been some abundance that may well have been stored, and they are heading north. And so it was 3,500 years ago. It wasn't north, but it was sort of south and west that a caravan of Joseph's brothers head to Egypt. And when they get to Egypt, what do they find? They find themselves face to face with the number two person in all of Egypt. This is a big deal. They don't recognize him. They don't know it's Joseph, because as far as they know, Joseph is dead. Joseph recognizes them, but doesn't let it be known. And they come face to face with this powerful man. And the story that Robin reads for us today is the story of amazing grace on the heart of Joseph, who sees his brothers and makes the ability for them to have food again. Except, if you're reading the whole story, that's not his first response. His first response in the chapters before, when he sees his brothers, is anything but gracious. In fact, his first response is exactly what you would have expected. He has been wronged. His brothers tried to kill him. They sold him into slavery. In a world of retributive justice, his world, and really our world, it makes perfect sense to get back, to get even. When wrong has been done to you, we make sure that the scales of justice are evened out by making sure that the others would suffer as well. And once everyone has suffered the same or paid their price to society, whatever it may be, then all is well. And so what we hear Joseph initially does, is he accuses them of being spies. This is the ancient world's version of fake news, all right? He accuses them of being spies, even though he knows they're not spies, because it makes them look bad. And then after that, after he accuses them of being spies, he throws them into jail. That's not all that dissimilar from people who have traveled thousands of miles, come up to our border, and find that they are seeking asylum, and instead of asylum, are thrown into jail, and their families are separated from them and thrown into different parts of the world. And after that, if that's not enough, he has them do these inhumane tasks, one after the other, which if you look at our own immigration system right now in our country, and we look at the way in which the hoops that we ask people to jump through, we recognize that not all that much has been changed, because those hoops are almost impossible to jump through, and yet we blame them for not jumping through the hoops. And then lastly, he accuses them again. Falsely accuses them again, not because they need to hear it, but because the people that Joseph controls, his base, the people that Joseph controls needs to know that he's in power. And so he accuses them again. And that's where everyone looking at the situation would have been absolutely clear is the way it should be. It's the way it should be. It's the way of the world. They harmed him. They wronged him. So therefore, he gets back at them. But there's really no accounting for grace, is there? There's really no accounting for that inexplicable reality in which grace can come in unexpectedly into our lives and transform us and allow us to take the ordinary, retributive justice and turn it into something extraordinary. The 12th century Islamic poet Hafiz, musing about the beauty of the rose, I think said some of the most beautiful words about grace. He says, "How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being." The rose felt the encouragement of light against its being. Has there ever been, I think, a more beautiful understanding of what grace is? The light of God speaking into the shadows of our very spirits and soul. Heart speaking to heart, spirit speaking to spirit. And at this moment, at the start of chapter 45 in Genesis, grace touches Joseph's life. And at this moment, the inexplicable happens. A transformation of his heart happens, and he does what is utterly unexpected. And he looks at his brothers as our chapter picks up, as Robin read for us, and he doesn't just recognize them, he now acknowledges them. And then he says, "You're starving. We have food. You can live here. Mi casa es su casa. My house is your house. Come." And oh, wait. Dad is still over there. There's family still over there. Your spouses, your children. Go get them. Bring your whole family here. The utterly unexpected and the extraordinary happens at that moment. Because grace, the light impressing upon us, changes his heart. And I think about that, and I think about how interesting might our whole debate on immigration in our country be if we just allowed a little bit of grace to enter into it. What policies we might see happening in our own country. You mean you're hungry and we have food? Come on in. Wait, you mean your family is still there and struggling? Come on in. You mean I can recognize you and embrace you? Why not do so? I'm just saying, perhaps a little bit of grace might go a long way in this world, in situations like this. Jesus, 1,500 years after this story happens, is talking with his disciples, and he more or less says the same thing. He says, "Love even your enemies. Do good to those who do you harm. Bless those who have cursed you. Pray for those who have mistreated you. Go the extra mile. Give your cloak. Turn the other cheek. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." These are not easy words. Jesus could just as easily say, "Why don't you just do as Joseph did? Why don't you just open your heart to the grace of God and allow yourself to be transformed and be changed?" And when you think about it, if we were to allow such reality to happen into the debates that make a part that are so much a part of our world these days, if we were to allow grace, if we were to allow the understanding of a different loving way to come in, how different might things be? Because let's face it, if the old way isn't working, if the old way of retributive justice is not working, if the old way that privileges the few and punishes the many isn't working, if the old way in which we are dealing with those who want power and possession and position and leave everyone else out, if that isn't working, then perhaps we need to try a new way. Perhaps we need to open ourselves to a new way and allow transformation, to allow grace to enter into it. Would that not make a difference in the conversations that we have about battles and wars that are being fought over resources, over that which are the gifts of the creation, which should be available to all, but some want to just make it for a few? Would that not change the nature of our conversation when we talk about being in a community that has the resources to make sure that everyone has a roof over their heads, and yet we demonize and punish those who have so little access to resources and leave them stranded on the streets? If we were to allow what happens to Joseph, to allow the encouragement of light on our hearts, would it not change our reality? Would it not begin to transform our world? What does that transformation look like? I want to take you all the Saturday after Easter, for those who wish to, on a hike to where we can understand that transformation. I want to take you all out to Ka'ena Point. I want to take you all out to Ka'ena Point because 25 years ago, there were some folks that looked at Ka'ena Point way out there on this most sacred place, one of the most sacred places on our island where our Hawaiian brothers and sisters believe that our souls go to jump when they have died into the next world. There were those that realized that Ka'ena Point had been destroyed or was in the process of being destroyed, and they made an effort to do one thing to protect a single native plant, the ohialii, out there on the point, that was barely able to survive, as is the truth of many of our native plants within our community. And they decided we're going to protect that ohialii. And to do so, we need to change the ways that we've been doing, just as Joseph had to recognize, I need to change how I have been, because if I am just going to be the way I always was, we're just going to always end up in conflict. And so instead, they made some changes out there. This land that had been destroyed by railroads and bulldozers and destroyed by neglect and trash and invasive plants, they instead decided to do something drastic, and they put up a barrier fence out there on the point. And after they put in the barrier fence, they did some work to remove invasive species, and they put in rat traps because rats were causing a whole bunch of problems. And what happens? The ohialii came back. The ohialii came back, and when we walk out there, you will see it is thriving. But not only that, when the ohialii came back and it had been cleared of those invasive species, what did they discover? But there were seeds that had laid dormant of all these other native plants as well, the naupaka, the ilima, the pohinihina, had all laid dormant. But now that the invasives were gone, they were able to thrive. And so when you walk out to Ka'ena, you see this place that looks like it looked like pre-contact, not just pre-Western contact, pre-Hawaiian contact. But not only that, once that place had begun to resemble, there was this wonderful other thing that began to happen. Native birds, the shearwater, began to come and make their nest there where they once had been, but had gone away. And even more amazing, the moli, the Laysan albatross, came back. Laysan albatrosses are amazing. They live 6 decades or more. One of the things that's amazing about them is they mate for life, and they always return from their voyages at sea to the place in which they were born. They come back to the place in which they were born, unless the place in which they were born no longer can support life, which had been the reality at Ka'ena Point. But as the ohialii came back, as the naupaka came back, the ilima came back, the pohinahina came back, as these plants came back, and as the invasives went away, somewhere in the brains of those moli, those Laysan albatross, they understood we need to keep looking at home. And finally, home was habitable again. And they landed, and they began to lay eggs. And now there are 90-plus nesting pairs of moli, Laysan albatross, out at Ka'ena Point. And when we go out there in April, at the time when the fledglings have been born, we will be there to see what transformation happens when we allow ourselves to allow grace to enter in, to allow our hearts to be touched, to allow the disconnect that has happened there with the land to be changed in just the same way that Joseph allowed the disconnect between his family, between his community, to be healed by the gift of grace. Be healed by God's ability to touch our hearts and to suggest in the touching of our hearts, can we not consider a different way? We live in a world that needs some different ways. We live in a world that desperately needs our openness to the encouragement of light upon our very presence, to the sound of heart speaking to heart, spirit speaking to spirit, to the ability and the wonder of grace to enter into not only our personal presence, but into the presence of ourselves as a community. Amen.